to Marie before about the ipso facto show,
yep.
And in particular a work called Horizon. Maybe lead us into that show and that particular piece, Horizon,
mm-hmm.
And then maybe on to the relationship you see between that show and the Stomata show.
Yeah.
Here. And then there's an interesting aside. What happened in those 12 to 15 years and why out of the gallery?
Yeah, that's an interesting aside. That's a hard aside to talk about. Now, I'll start with the Horizon show. There was actually three shows that were very close together at the time. The Horizon show, which was part of ipso facto at CCP. There was another one called Planning, which had T-squares. And there, earlier than that, there was an exhibition at Linden called An Image from Within and Without. And all three of those exhibitions, I used the space almost as a solid. And often what I did was sort of slice it up. It's the same in the ipso facto show. The spot that I got was the main gallery. The idea of ipso facto was other ways of imagining photography, particularly three-dimensional. So there was a number of people in the exhibition who were along the lines that I do. And at the time, I was very interested in perspective and perspectival kind of interrogation of the space. So with that,
I should say that was a show that was curated by Stuart Coop. At CCP in 1999?
I think it was 96 or 97.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the essay, actually. But I think
All right.
Or it might have been 98. Somewhere in that kind of mid-late 90s.
Okay.
And anyway, the what I did in that particular exhibition was work with the idea of the horizon, and I had a big metal plate that sat out away from the window on a brace, and the word horizon was perforated through the plate. When you were looking at the word horizon, there was a beam in the middle of the window that held the window up because it was such a large horizontal expanse that the letter I in the middle of the word horizon disappeared behind the beam. That is, it was perforated through metal, but it got blacked out because of the beam holding the middle of the window up. So the eye of the self or the eye, the physical eye in the body, it kind of disappeared when you actually stood in the right spot to see the word. So it was also a play on perspective and where the eye sits and where the self sits in relation to perspective.
Sure.
And how things are taken in. And in the wall behind, when you're looking out the window, the word horizon was drilled through the wall, or again perforated lettering, just like on the steel plate, but it was upside down, like when an image hits the lens of the eye or the lens of the camera, it's upside down.
Yeah.
And now on the reverse, on the back gallery, because you know you're never CCP at the front gallery and back gallery.
Yes.
And back gallery was also drilled in the wall, but right side up again. And smaller, so it also became decreasing. So that kind of buttonhole that images go through. As I mentioned, there was a couple of exhibitions that I had around that time. A prior one at Linden, which was, again, a historic space. I like to work in older spaces, or like this, spaces that have had a lot of different lives that are industrial. The white box doesn't particularly interest me. I don't necessarily make work in the studio and then take it to gallery. I have a kind of mixed project based and studio based practice. I've been studio based occasionally when I had a studio, and I mostly have project based kind of practice where I work on projects as they rise and I develop them over a period of time like this one.
Mm.
The Linden exhibition was a bit similar but focused on a tree that was outside the Linden Gallery, which had been replanted. It's a reproduction of the original garden, and it had only been replanted about a year prior to that exhibition. And when Linden had their 10-year anniversary, they asked me to redo that exhibition, and I actually found that quite difficult to do because the tree had grown out of sight of the window, all you could see was the trunk, so I couldn't really reproduce the image of the tree. And I won't go into great detail about how that looked, but again, it was another way of slicing the space up vertically. Except I used, instead of the simple kind of eye of the self, I used heat in that exhibition. So outside was the tree, outside the bay window. In the bay window was a big tracery steel outline of the tree, an exact outline of that tree. It was a group pine. This was in the space in Linden where it's the long one that has the beautiful archway. In the archway was another space frame holding an A4 size metal frame with another outline of the tree that was made of nichrome wire, which is the wire inside human elements or inside the kettle.
Okay.
So it's just that it's skinny, it's only about the size of a pencil lead. And when someone came into the gallery, it would turn on and glow red.
Yeah,
it's the kind of exhibition you couldn't do now because of insurance. At all. You couldn't even go there because it also used to throw sparks. Oh, it's because it would oxidize every. So every few days I had to go and I had a whole series of little trees that I would go and change. And in the fireplace was a steel tracery image, where again I used these big, often the image of a fire set in the fireplace, but just again, made of steel. And when the paint was sticky, I put these beads on it. And what I was working with in that was, again, how something from inside, from outside, like the tree, the image comes in, is it becomes acculturated by, you know, coming into the space. And you have a bay window, you plant a tree outside, it's that picture, that framing of the outdoors, of nature, of, you know, the outside world. And I was playing with the raw, the idea of the raw and the cooked. And particularly Judith Williamson's idea that nature is also goes through a process of cooking, of acculturation, and literally kind of gets cooked into culture. So we take the raw things from nature and we cook them into culture. So that's why the middle tree, the one that was in the arch, which if I were to compare it to the show, it's a photo was where the horizon was drilled through the wall. That's where the tree was flipped upside down, and it was also a heating element. So again, like the arm. So, and there was another exhibition I had at the basement where I used a lot of T-squares. The basement had a colonnaded archway. So you walked in and it was a straight, long space ahead of you that had a colonnaded archway on the left, and the main space was inside to the left of that. And most artists work in the gallery, that it was in the space. I decided to work only with the colonnade and I left the space empty. Right? So I often leave spaces quite empty. In all the shows I've described, the spaces are nearly empty. And what I did in that exhibition was lean T-squares up against all the colonnades of the arch.
I think I saw that one too.
You got out a lot then. Like, yeah,
at
one
point in time I did, yeah.
Yeah. And that space had been a number of different things in its life. It had no windows or doorways, but had a lot of blocked up chimneys. And one of the things that it had been was an apothecary. And when you walked down into the space, there was a lot of people didn't notice it, but there was a series of prints on the wall about the history of the space and what it had been, because it was a very famous building in its time. It was one of the first buildings in Melbourne to have an atrium, which is very common in Europe. So the building's basically built like a donut, like an extruded donut, and then the light comes down through the inside all the way down to the basement where the apothecary was. And the apothecary was the main part of the business. That's why the building was built. That's what was there. It took up most of the floors to begin with. But of course, over the years, it had been a brothel, a hotel, and a series of businesses like it was at the time. So it was playing with that idea of how things are planned and they change. So in coming to Conical, one of the continuing interests in my work in my writing has been, Judith Williamson's writing has stuck with me a long time, the idea of the acculturation of nature, and through the thesis that I did, I studied how nature is advertised, and or nature is used in advertising, particularly for selling green products. And I pretty quickly realized that nature is entirely a kind of construction of society, and that's the only way in which we can understand it. And so over time I've blended that interest with my practice in a much deeper way, in a way that I was sort of really just beginning to do, say in the Linden exhibition, or indeed in the Horizon exhibition. Again, I'm referencing the outdoor and landscape and the exterior. But in those interceding years that you asked about, where I started to work outside, I thought really to prove my mettle, it would be good for me to start to work outdoor in the public domain. And there's this idea that I do public art. I've never actually done public commission. I've been shortlisted for many, and I very often have been on the panel to receive them, but I've just been in big exhibitions, like Letters, big outdoor exhibitions, survey exhibitions like McClelland and Olympia, and a few others in Queensland and so on. So the text-based work I've done also, in a way, came out of the study that I did in my thesis of the relationship between nature and culture, and how nature is always acculturated in a distance and can't be known. So what I was interested in with Conical was returning, if you like, to that gallery work, and Adrian and I talked a bit about this to begin with, of working indoors and with historic space and something else that's very, you know, I didn't want to use the view. I started out with the idea of the view, so I spoke to Adrian originally about using the windows like I did in the CCP. But for a few reasons, I decided not to do that, because the atmosphere here is actually very interesting, which is what you realize when you spend a bit of time in here, and it doesn't actually take spending very much time in here at all to sample the streets.
Thank you.
What was that? I'll have to chase it down and pay him later.
So I'm getting a sense of you, you know, the nature and culture sort of thematic, but I'm also getting this sense of you moving in and out of specificity, whether it's, you know, a sort of architectural specificity or historical, or, you know, generally a sort of a boundedness to a particular context of a project. Yet nature and culture are obviously more abstract universal themes that are carried through these projects. And it's a curious sort of dichotomy, I think, that's going on with this show between that sort of say physical specificity and more universal sort of dialogue with the pictorial, you know, opticality, abstraction, in, you know, experiential language. All these types of things are sort of much more universal than, say, direct architectural intervention.
The architectural intervention kind of course. I suppose I feel like I had done that in that sort of middle to late 90s thing, and had done it, albeit always with this kind of very light touch. And I wanted to pull away from that specifically, you know, working specifically architecturally or in an interventionist kind of way. And I've started to script the word intervention out of my
Does become a sort of laboured, burdened sort of approach that doesn't really take into account sort of the contemporary modular way of working
or fragmentary. It can become very specific. And I think that that's also why I had to make a break working in galleries for a while, because it got to be, you know, the history of the building and, you know, where the bricks were made, and, you know, it just got to the, it could get to this point that's sort of ridiculous and begins to collapse. You know,
yet on some of the documentation I'd see that your the limited sort of public works that I did they seem more physically, environmentally specific than perhaps even some of the gallery works, the basement work, for example. So, I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, working outdoors is a very, very particular challenge, and I found it really challenging to begin with. And it's a real ethos, kind of big, heavy metal work. And, you know, or stuff that will survive. There's this real emphasis. It's almost as though the 70s and early 80s didn't exist in terms of ephemera. A lot of people, and certainly galleries and large order exhibitions, they want you to make stuff that's very permanent and, you know, that they can acquire, because a lot of those big sculpture prizes are acquisitive. And it's very hard to sort of work against that. And indeed, a lot of the kind of permutations we see of things like the Maduro sculpture triennial and the way that was revived end up being gallery exhibitions. So when we had the Melbourne Biennale, which was in some ways grew out of Maduro triennial, that was in part one of the things that was revisiting, and I was involved in the exterior committee for that, and I was one of the visual artists on the panel when it was being developed. I thought it was a fantastic exhibition, and yet it was also very much an indoor exhibition in the Telstra building, which is now the Bureau building and the apartments. You know, it's really, in fact, wasn't dealing with a lot of the things that were being looked at in those earlier outdoor exhibitions, which were very temporary. And it's not that I'm sort of calling to, you know, the work should go in that direction. Indeed, there's a lot of young artists who are working in that sort of way, like Ash Keaton. I'm interested to see how they're how that will eventually play out. And my interest isn't necessarily with ephemera either. So it's kind of, it's in that kind of interstitial space between the architectonic, which is a very strong thing. It's been going on in contemporary practice for quite a while, and indeed it's a huge part of what I've been teaching in years I've been at the UCA too. But a kind of awareness of the subtler things like atmosphere. So what if, in coming to Chronicle, I was very tempted, and my original proposal was to work with the view, and I decided after a while that it just wasn't going to work, and also it had been done to death by a number of people who've worked in the space over time. That a lot of people have, you know, used the view of Johnson Street or this view, you know, out to the east and so on over time. And not that I am fussed about people having done it before, but also the windows didn't lend themselves to it because they're each one is different. You know, they have some louvers and some don't, and some are tinted and some aren't. And so I started to think about what other aspects of the space as indicative of an environment that's bigger, of, you know, very urbanized, very busy sort of suburb that is Fitzroy, which isn't even really a suburb anymore. I think it's just an urb. It's an urban environment, very, you know, heavily so. And when you spend time in here, I think you realize how raw the space is. Yeah.
Is it? I was going to say, Ted, I was wondering about this sort of material history that you've sort of researched to a degree, and then you've executed in terms of how you've you know, talked about the material of the bricks. You've sort of researched the air vents, etc. I wonder how you felt about the more social history. We did talk about the original use of this building, and I guess the bigger point of the question is, how do we feel about just a physical history or a material history, and, you know, working with architecture when I guess we're looking for what working with architecture could mean in a social sense.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. In relation to, say, Rem Koolhaas's comment, all we have left is the flow of people. You know, yeah. It's like, yeah. What does a building mean?
Yeah. That's right. Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it would be very easy for me to say I'm not actually particularly interested in the social history, because I've done that to death in my work previously as well. I you know, we talked about where the stairwell used to be and a few other things about this building and what it used to be.
And how can we really know it?
That's right. That's right. And that idea of whatever the space once was, that continued to reverberate in some way in the space. And indeed it does. Like the way that you pointed out, that there's a brick on the wall left over from a previous exhibition where someone removed bricks and then they put it back in. It's never quite the same again.
The tinting has been put on the windows by various artists. You know.
Yeah. The things, you know, they become this kind of, you know, accumulation of things, and so they're sort of like a pamphlet. You know, they get erased, they get rewritten, they get re-inscribed. What I am wanting to try to do with this exhibition is push the social context to something much larger, and that's why I wanted to work with air instead of the specific view of here, because the air is everywhere, and you know, particularly in an urban environment, it's very particulate. It's very particular, and it's very particular. It's quite gritty here, yeah. And part of that's the building itself, sort of, you know, it's always kind of crumbling, and not just the stuff on the chimney, but, you know, under the windows. And I've made a point not to sweep at all during the exhibition. The only part that I've, you know, replaced and kept clean is the chimney.
That must have been hard for you, bro.
Adrian's remarking there, and that I spent the first day vacuuming. But that's and it is a bit of a meditation. It's a bit like, you know, walking a maze in a church for me. I have to spend some actual time in the space. Now, I had, from having been to many exhibitions here, I knew that the light did that in the chimney. And I had that in my mind as something I'd like to be able to use if I could. But it wasn't hard and fast, because I know that it's fickle and ephemeral and so on. And I didn't want the show to necessarily be about ephemera, but to be about something larger. And that's why I thought, I won't work with the windows. They're too big and too grand. The vents are this incredibly mundane, historic thing that doesn't even get used anymore. They're no longer needed. They're really from the time of coal fires, which is why I did a little bit of research on them. I mean, and that might look like sort of, you know, deep level research, but when you do research as part of, you know, your practice, it's not, it's a few days research.
Sure, events, that kind of digging
around and finding out about them and why they exist and why those particular kind exist.
Is it that 15-gridded style?
Yeah, not the 15-gridded style, but that they're terracotta. Because about 10 years later, most of them were metal. And in fancier buildings, they're often metal. Like on the police stables near the BCA, if you, as you walk down Grand Street, you pass a parade of them. And actually, they're at head height because the ground drops away and the building is actually higher. They're cast iron and they're florate. So they're, you know, kind of a flower pattern. And that's called rinseau, that kind of pattern. So there was that kind of sense of ornamentation of the industrial, of the sort of everyday at the time. But in bulk standard buildings like this, which were, you know, remembering the history of Fitzroy, is what it is. It was, you know, a workers' suburb to begin with. This would have always been a building in which people worked and which was always about industry. So they were utilitarian, you know, just kind of, and very rough, you know, which is also why I used a very rough picture for the invitation. I mean, I could have, you know, gotten on a ladder and taken a close-up. Beautiful sort of picture, but they're kind of experienced in a very...
They were slate lined around the outside of these. They've been since fitted out to be kind of the slickest thing in the joint.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it was very funny.
Cold chiselling them out, fit monitors in. none of them fitted, and they, you know, like, make massive indentations just to try and get these models in.
Didn't realise they were slate lined. They're all different sizes, yeah. So are the windows. I vacuumed the floor, but I also measured every window, I measured every vent, you know, like it, that's part of the kind of information gathering part of my process, which actually doesn't then just culminate in an exhibition. Information gathering is kind of continual, you know, so there's always, and that's a bit what a project-based practice is about, the stuff I carry from one exhibition to the next, you know. Like, I still have the T-squares, indeed, they're in my car, because I've just worked them out of my office to take with me to Tasmania.
There's a cumulative.
There's a cumulative kind of process in the work.
And they become very idiosyncratic as well, like, you sort of put all this sort of personal meaning into them.
Perhaps. I don't know, it depends.
Or psychological?
I think it's probably, part of it's that thing of becoming one's own archive, as you do, as any artist does. I think that's a particular kind of burden for people who work sculpturally, because you end up with a lot of stuff, and a lot of big stuff, and a lot of stuff that's hard to get rid of, and it's not particularly sellable, and, you know, it's the kind of stuff I say to my students, who want to play this game, you've got to be willing to lose a lot, you know, it's partly that. I don't think I hang on to too much out of sentimentality, it's more about what it might be used for another time.
Those window boards look great down the whole system.
And you'd really love me to take them with you. And this was really interesting because you were wanting to change the window boards. And so I had free rein to do whatever I wanted with them. So I could have drawn them out, I could have, you know. And that was my intention.
The initial discussion was probably the death of this introduced sort of infrastructure that we brought in here a couple of years ago, which was, you know, the denial of what's going on outside.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite sort of mediated situation because initially I stripped all the glass out of this place and it felt like a, you know, fishbowl hovering above Johnson Street. You know, the chaos of the sort of urban hubbub just was right on you.
Yeah.
And it was really exposed and very vulnerable. So, you know, a decision was made to probably, you know, two-thirds of it was sort of cancelled out by obscure glass, and then there were some clear glass elements that I decided to put back in to create some framework. Just some framing, I guess, of outside views to not conceal it totally.
Yeah.
And so these window panels were really a response to a lot of artists wanting to cancel out everything, including the light.
Many artists do. Yeah.
You know, and it was quite interesting with the recent Sonia Lieber and David Chesworth show how they went to great effort to get acoustic sort of foaming on the back of these panels to try and block out as much noise.
Yeah.
So this sort of sense of denial has been quite strong in the space over the last couple of years, particularly with a lot of new media, you know, with a lot of video work.
Video work.
Contrast, etc.
Yeah. Well, video, all of those, that way of working is just within its own frame, within its own bubble, and bubble has to be protected.
You know, and that sort of autonomy, that new media formalism, as I like to coin it, is a whole other discussion. But you've come in and picked on, a physical introduced structure that you know, we've made on a budget to try and negotiate with artists wanting to block all or partially, you know, what's going on inside. Yet what you've done is not assertively cut into them, and you know, what you've done is just sort of subtly intervened with them to the point where they become these highly sort of optical Terrell-like, you know, objects. And you know, that is a very subtle intervention that only some viewers, I think, are really picking up on.
Yeah, I think so too. I think there's a lot of people who don't pick up on that layer, particularly if they've never been in the space before. They might just think, oh, they're just under covers and they're kind of doing their job.
So where do they go first then? Where do they look first?
You mean where do people look first? Nearly everyone looks at the ceiling first. Yeah. Which is why I left the ceiling component in. Because I did play with the idea of only doing the panels and the fireplace. But then what happens is the work becomes the fireplace and nothing else. It's the odd number problem. If you have three components in an exhibition, like the three legs on the stool in front of us, people engage, have a number of points with which they can engage. Not everyone goes straight for what's up first, but most people.
There's an eye element of, you know, low angle, high angle, and eye level that's going on with these pieces.
Yeah. And it was too big a jump to just go from high to low, to just make it only about the vents. And there is a lot of air and noise that comes in from the windows, but it leaks. It's that sense of, you know, like when you. When you imagine cold pouring out of a refrigerator, there's always that sense that it drops and rolls across the floor. You know, and you imagine it as a myth. Mm. So that is why I left the ceiling elements, because there was a time when I thought I'd take them out.
At this juncture, I'd like to actually talk about this relationship between deviations and subversions and even perversions of or detournement of habituated spaces, particularly in a gallery, the architectural normative architectural conditions that are associated with the gallery as you see it, and I guess the relationship between social history and the specificity of the site that came up earlier. I'd like to do it by talking about the bigger picture that was introduced right at the beginning, and that's the relatively arbitrary but extremely useful opportunity of comparing the work from 15 or so years ago with this one now, Horizon. Right? Now, the way you were describing Horizon, particularly as I'm sitting in this space here and imagining the relationship that has occurred across this period of practice, I can see a series of transitions, some of which are micro and others that are macro, and transitions and continuities that are occurring between these two works, right, across this big span of time, and maybe we can talk about those in a moment, but what I'd like to talk about now is the distinction, the difference between these two works. It strikes me that the Horizon piece is very much a kind of, to use a word that was used before, an explicit intervention in a space, not so much to disrupt it, but to kind of clarify something that is occurring in that space. Yeah. And the rhetorical strategy that this employs, though in a somewhat kind of analytical and conceptual idiom, is, I would call it, neo-baroque. In the way you describe, from a certain position, the eye, which is the linguistic signifier of the perceiver, you know.
The eye beam, as David calls it.
The eye beam. The eye beam behind them, you know, this quite loaded kind of, you know, semiotic gesture of yours to, you know, to fuse and kind of cancel out the viewing subject. This is very much like the kind of strategy in a Baroque church, right? Mm. Particularly in the way that, say, you know, with quadrature painting, with the, you know, especially up with the ceilings. There's one privileged position in which the illusion works, right? And the entire apparatus for all of its cosmological power is directing you towards this one position, which is one of supremacy of an instant of subjectivity, which is one with the kind of grandeur of the of God. Okay. Now, there's, of course, you know, like in terms of art history. Social history of that kind of work was enormous. Determinations of that moment of subjectivity through Jesuitical spiritualism and so on, right? Sensuousness of existence in the world and the communing with the divine and so on, but also through the rhetoric of public space and particularly in, say, French Baroque. Sovereignty itself, right? Not just the sovereignty of God, but
sovereignty of the king. So I would see that the work of Horizon, while it gestures towards this horizon, you know, which is a gesture towards the beyond and the infinite, is also about the finitude of the subject, very much in a Baroque way. Mm. Now, if we then jump this great span, space across to where we are now, in this environment, there is no privilege of position. There is no sovereignty of either the subject or of the subject's perception of something other than itself. There's no rhetorical positioning of the viewer that allows us to comprehend our place in the space. The word that would come to my mind to describe what this is, and it's prefigured in the word that you use the word atmosphere a lot, I'd say the word is atmospherics or ambience. Mm. Right? In other words, the ambience of this work seems to be at odds with the directed rhetoric of the earlier work. Mm. Now, this may be a process of change, of course, but there also seems to be a conflict. I don't mean, you know, like a conflict that's bad.
Yeah.
I mean an interesting deviation and response to the earlier work.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's very interesting. There's a couple of devices which are similar, like looking up. And as you probably know, again, this is part of the Baroque, when you look up, you lose your peripheral vision to a certain degree, so your attention is completely focused. So in this work, yes, I'm trying to not put so much focus on the singular subject, but on the broader one, the sort of the ambient one, the atmospheric one, if you like, the collective fact. If I were to put the social spin on it, would be the much broader, planar atmosphere. And that idea that's in the essay of the aerial ocean, it's something that fits much larger than the anthropocentric self, which is part of my frustration in my study of you know, acculturated nature. That even a concern for the environment, for example, is completely anthropocentric to some degree. It's really primarily about us.
Mm.
And what I think through the study that I've done in the interim, that eye of the self, and indeed the kind of frustration I feel with the eye of the artist, which can very often be incredibly, you know, self-contained and self-reflective, I'm trying to set up a conflict with that and not have a center or have an empty center. So, like your questioning when you first came in the gallery, you know, it was clear you didn't quite know where to stand, you know, and I saw that as people were coming in during the opening, and because I've been here a number of times since, they kind of come in, they look up, they wander around, and they try to sort of figure out where the work is. And a lot of them think perhaps that those who are looking for a very singular solution will find one in the fireplace. If they need one, it's there. But it isn't. I find once they sort of see the fireplace, they then look at the vents. And as soon as you start to blink, all you see is the vents, because the dots on your eyes is what you're left with. And that's from looking up. And you become, through a process of kind of attrition almost, pulled into the work, but it's a slow process. And I totally understand that not everybody's going to have that sort of patience. Indeed, you know, the video work requires a great deal of patience too. So I think it is an interesting conflict. I think I've shifted that kind of very overt sense of the subject and the self away from that, move away from that into something broader. Isn't quite the right word, but more stretched and continuous and not so easily defined in a singular way, but perhaps in an experiential way.
There's a conceptual argument behind this work, which is different to the kind of relatively speaking to Horizon. Horizon is a sort of tautological, analytical statement.
Yeah, bordering on didactic. Yeah. To me now, when I look at that work, and you know, it's one becomes critical of one's work over time.
Well, we could say, I mean,
it had a trick. It worked.
This is going to sound a little pretentious, but it is a cutting distinction. We could say that Horizon is a very analytical work. And that you can see a horizon, but it's not actually important that you see the horizon.
Yeah.
You know, you know that the horizon is there already,
yeah.
And you know that the language that is naming this horizon.
Yeah.
Is not so much an act of ostensibly pointing to an actual horizon, naming it. It's about saying, well, here's an example of a horizon. But the horizon that you're really dealing with is the word itself, right? So it's kind of Kossuth type of, argument.
It's a cultural framing of the horizon. Yeah. But perhaps here we're talking more about atmospherics than we are about horizons.
Okay.
You know, we've sort of moved from... you know, a textual language and a cultural framing of something to actually working with real atmospherics in a way.
Mm.
And, you know, and atmospherics are palpable. I mean, Virilio calls the celestial sphere, the third front in bunker archaeology, a palpable space that we're now using or was using post-war as a place to operate in.
Mm.
The space is no longer imagined, but it's functional.
Mm.
So I tend to feel that your monthly... or in some way truncating the latent power of atmospherics here and we've had the discussion about the rafter work, but the way that people respond to the exhibition, my observations over the last 3 or 4 weeks, is that they look up and they're not pressed into the service of the atmospherics. They're not asked to really engage because you're giving them a language that they're much more familiar with. Much easier to communicate with, which is the pictorial introduced language.
Mm, it's a tricky thing, though. That...
And to then ask, you know, for them to move from that into a more experiential phenomenology, you know, I can never pronounce that properly, phenomenology, is confusing for a lot of viewers. And that has been the... that has really been the overriding impression I've got from viewers for the show, in that how do they make that transition? How are you asking them to do that?
Mm.
But that's that you've introduced that device to the pictorial. Like, you really want to look at these things closer up, and you want to look at them at this eye level. So being denied that, I mean, it was the same. I keep thinking of these video pieces that were put up here. You could never watch the detail in the video. It's in the end of this point. So it's like this, you can't look at them in detail, so then you are left with what's underneath that, you know, just trying to pull down that pictorial hierarchy by placing it. What do you call the things? Are they parchments or are they...
They don't have a name, and that's very important. They're up high because they're not to the objects. You know, they are objects, but I'm denying their objecthood in the same way I'm denying... And I think denial is it's a very powerful device.
It's obfuscated. It's hidden away.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, it's inevitable that they're going to have a decorative look to them.
There is that desire to want to look at them that way.
And I mean, the first thing that I felt when I came in was that they resemble prayer flags or some sort of, you know, distressed, damaged, you know, weathered gesture to the gods. Right? Mm. I mean, that's why they're going up high.
Yeah.
They look like some sort of signal, you know, to whatever is the emptiness in the space above,
mm.
right?
Mm.
But then, you know, if that's the space of the head, I mean, the stain is, you know,
the space of the body.
Crude way, it's the body.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you know, these just look like nappies, right? They look like soiled nappies, and this just looks like shit. Now, I try to put those two things together, right? You know, the kind of anus and the you know the eye going up, right? I put them together when they're on those rafters, and what I see, particularly as I walk into the space, as I see the row of these three vents up here, not so much the ones on the side, but I see this pattern because they're in alignment with these whatever they are, the parchment, flag, empty things. It looks like the air is causing this sustained
gradation of
like a filter.
So the air is shit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's an intriguing thought, isn't it? The air is shit. I don't mean it's polluted.
Yeah.
I mean it leaves the stain of something excremental. It is associated not so much with the respiratory system, but with the alimentary canal.
Yeah, and that it's an organism of its own. You know that it operates somewhat independently.
So again, the air can be a base material. A little bit like pointing towards the celestial as a functional space, a space that we now command.
I would imagine that the weather that we've had this last time when you've been here, that you've had some pretty dramatic breathing of these panels
to sort of push that idea along. The 2 weeks preceding the opening and the opening night were very hot, and the change came and it was much nicer outside, but very hot here. I mean, it was a real trial for people. By then I was acclimatized to it as you get used to it, kind of suffocating me. But that idea of working against them as objects, but working with them as a stain, or as you say, as an element. I mean, air is actually very complex. It's made up of a lot of different elements, and only a small part of which is what we need. Only a small part of which is oxygen. And yet, you know, the way buildings are built are very often aligned, analogous to the body. The idea of, you know, a shell that breathes and it has to operate like a skin. Much of the language around it.
There's a whole sort of physiology of architecture, if you like.
And it always sets up this polarity or dichotomy between the inside and the outside, the things that are being kept out, the things that are retained or left in, or created in inside. And I'm trying to kind of turn that inside out. But not pictorially, and not in a way that has to do with landscape or the representation of what's outside, but in a way that's physical. And I realise, of course, that a lot of people will zip through and not get it. My work isn't for the impatient. Never has been. in that way, I'm used to that.
It's not so much that, Marie. I think it's more that some viewers might find it as an obstruction.
Yeah. It's obdurate. The work is obdurate.
To the greater claim of the installation, if you like.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you've set up a certain, you know, sort of platform, and then, you know, sort of truncated shifted that. But then, how effective is that to being able to, you know, give you agency over that initial platform that you set up? That's the question. Not so much about whether you've obscured or not, but is it effective or productive?
Yeah.
You know,
well, I mean, in a way, that plays very nicely into the hand of, you know, what atmosphere is. It's a given. It's a sort of known thing. And until it's truncated, or it's all bad, or you find yourself in a smoggy city, or weather that's difficult,
you don't notice it.
You don't notice it. You very much entirely take it for granted until it's abbreviated, or made wrong, or made unfit. Mm. And so, to me, that's an apt way to work with it, because how else, you know, in fans, you know, it'd be about air, and it's about movement. If one's speaking about atmosphere, it's those sort of subtle changes in pressure and humidity and heat and regulation, and I mean just the kind of fascination of the weather. It's intriguing, but I agree with you that it's truncated, and I think that's a really interesting observation. I think of it as kind of stubborn and obdurate. It can be a little hard to get into, but I've also found that the people who read work often, who will spend a bit of time with the work, have come back to me and
it's interesting that you know, we've talked about, say, the abject and talk about, you know, shit, maybe even Neo-Battalian sort of sense of them. But what I was intrigued about was my initial response to the title was bodily, you know.
You
sort of think about, you know, sort of colostomy bag.
Yet
you came back and said, well, no, it's more of a, well, I'm thinking of it as a botanical reference.
Yeah.
But we're essentially talking about the same thing, aren't we? We're talking about sort of orifices and, you know, ways to sort of breathe and ways to emit waste.
Yeah.
We're talking about porosity. We're talking about engaging with, you know, the border of the skin and the world
and how we respirate,
etc.
Yeah.
But
it's more of like.
But by putting this imagery up here, you've certainly directed a lot of viewers to more of a bodily reference, I think.
Yeah, and that was in order to make the connection between the architecture and the body. That's I felt that's where that had to be played out. As it, like I said, I could have done it without those, and the work becomes about only about the fireplace. Because people look for an object. It's the easy thing. The people look for, an image in painting or form in sculpture. They look for what is going to give them a reference outside of what they see immediately in front of them, generally. And
it's an interesting mediation.
It's hard to slow that process down.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge I'm interested in, is how you not rein it in or pull it back, but how you kind of open it and unfold it and leave it open for, kind of several interpretations. And instead of the idea of respiration, it's actually more like the idea of transpiration.
Okay.
If I were to rename the show, perhaps that's what I would rename it. But again, that's also very much about, specifically about breathing, and becomes anthropocentric again. And that's why I chose Stomata, because of its ambiguity. Not that everybody remembers from high school biology that it's, a plant that all can breathe, as well as, if you have a tracheotomy, you get a stomata as well as a colostomy bag. I mean, any hole in the body, and there's stomata support societies where people have holes in their body, which is interesting, because we all have holes in our body. So, but if you're, if you have one that isn't where
like
it's supposed
extra.
To be, you belong to a support group. And it's, that idea of the whole, of where things pass through or, get filtered, or that, and maybe this is where it leads back to horizon. If there is a singular point at which that happens, and that's perhaps the sort of quantum of the title of the show.
I think the point of singularity, or at least of positioning, the way you feel that you've reached the right place. This is the quality of the Baroque, where you accept the authority of the frame, even as you commit transgressions against the frame in a Baroque environment. You see things rippling outside the frame, and the frames multiply, the architecture, the cornices, are split and broken and multiplied and so on. But at a certain position where you're not dealing with detail, right, where the eye is not kind of like tripping and falling over and moving beyond, where that position occurs, where you look up or look into a space and you know your place in the world, right, as a subject of the sovereign or as a religious devotee, right? That kind of position does happen also in the sort of perception of natural cycles and deep ecology that's being implied. If we see buildings as being transpiring organisms, and we see that the flow of light and air in and out of a building as being capable of reaching a kind of homeostasis, of a kind of self-sustaining organism, that can live and die according to natural law, right, and not transgress that law, right, not pervert it, not become decadent, not become super productive and cancerous, right? Mm. If we accept that sort of homeostatic balance, it's very much a kind of new age idea, of achieving this state of harmony. That's why I would say, the concept of transpiration is a sort of, it's a very convivial and consoling concept. When you're in a building, for instance, that accumulates dirt and dust and so on, to think, well, actually, in a way, if only we recognize what the flow of light and air is, we can see our position in the greater part of things. I would say that the thing that contravenes that, the thing that blocks that sort of self-satisfied, ecological sense of grasping the gestalt, you know.
If only we could open ourselves to it.
That's right. You know. But the thing that blocks that,
just
that makes it feel sick, right? Makes it actually feel sick. And this is the thing that I enjoy, is the stain, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing, you know, this shitty thing.
Yeah.
That,
like, yeah.
It turns the air foul, right?
Yeah.
And seems like, in a way that is only the triumph of art, is pointless. Right? It's not telling me anything. It's not telling me anything about the system of space, the system, the traffic of human movement throughout a gallery. It's not telling me about the rhetoric of the white cube or the black hole. It's not telling me anything. It's just saying, this is this extra bit of muck, you know, this thing that kind of like is unaccountable.
Yeah.
That's why when I looked up, I thought, at first, I thought, what the hell is that? I mean, I don't know what that's going on, but you know, and I can see the glow of the light around the thing, very much like Terrell, very consoling again. You know, this becoming, you know, like sitting myself back and pacifically kind of enjoying, you know, the absorption into nature, you know, and this kind of mock sublime, you know, that we have now, you know, particularly in Terrell, you know, this film. Yes, in fact, you know, like, architecture and nature can give me back this feeling, you know, being in some sort of primordial state. We can, you know. If you always do it on a volcanic scale, you know, you get a massive crater, you get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then in the end, you know, like, yeah.
We talked about Doug Aitken's Sonic Pavilion.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you're familiar with that work that he's done over in Brazil, where he's dug this huge hole right down to, you know, almost the core of the earth and dropped 60 microphones in it, and you sit in this pavilion on the top, and you actually hear the earth creaking on its axis. And, you know, supposedly he's critiquing the idea that the substrata has something to tell us. But I think essentially it's sort of a sublime
I had a very interesting conference last week, Media Art History. We had a number of speakers. One in particular was talking about the use of technology that developed throughout the 1940s and 50s to try and record these radio waves, you know, that were present in the atmosphere.
Sure.
It's around the same time as the discovery of the Van Allen belt and things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there were these otherwise invisible electromagnetic belts and wave phenomenal effects. Mm-hmm. In particular, a thing that was can't remember what that was called now, but it was a gradual, very very slow sine wave that was picked up at a certain level of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is. It's to do with the Earth's rotation. So
mm-hmm.
But two interesting things came out of two directions. One half of the audience was saying, you know, this is like the Earth pulse. You know, this, we must go back, you know, and understand, you know, respect that, you know, these are the voices of the spheres.
Phenomenological
music of the spheres again.
Yeah,
right? And you could see that the whole wave of this phenomenon from, at least the scientific appropriation of this, the artistic appropriation of this phenomenon, cultural at any rate, through from the 40s. Was leading towards a kind of new age spiritualism, right? It was endorsing a lot of these ideas that had been esoteric, you know, before in esoteric knowledge arcana. We can be completely trivialised and, you know, just becoming, you know, self-gratifying kind of ideas about your place in the world, you know, honouring the earth and that sort of thing. On the other hand, there was this other weird side of it, which was to do with things like brainwashing and so on. Because the same thing that was, same time that these things were being heard, they're also picking up, like, you know, alpha and beta waves in the brain, and they're, you know, like, they're registering into brain activity that can actually physically occur, you know, intervene in the world. Around the same time, in the 50s, a series of experiments, particularly at MIT, people who were able to turn lights on and off not with an electro-galvanic response of the skin, but with actually like brain waves, you know, that were being picked up by an apparatus attached to the head. This perverse side, right, of the invisible universe, you know, of radiation. I find this is what I'm seeing up here. Something like that. This is the kind of, you know, stain, you know, that's left on the New Age spirit.
I'm sort of thinking more to the opposite. Like this week, I've been watching the petrol station get sort of knocked down, and they've finally gone in to, you know, renovate that space. And underneath, they've got all the buildings knocked down, and then they've dug the big hole to pull the two tanks out that hold the stuff. And it just dawned on me that those big tanks, they look like big whales, are actually the same size as the thing that you drives around all day. So I never realised that the back of the tank would fit, be the same size as the piece that was underneath the petrol station. Because they dig, and then they dig that out, then they dig the two tanks out, they sit them up there for the whole joint stinks, the top of Victoria stinks. You know, you just walk around with a mask, you know. And kids have been playing in there for ages and ages, and I'm going, oh, God, this is what's actually been under this petrol station all this time. And then once they got the two big tanks out, the two big truck tanks out, then they got, you know, there's another concrete layer underneath. And then they dig that out, and then they start the excavation. Mm-hmm. And these things more remind me of the, you know, the actual hazards, the physical hazards of what does stay here.
People are getting hooked up in the organ, and that's how you've treated the building as an organ that the atmospherics sort of pass through in a mediated vibe. So most people are expecting the organ to contain the abject and the stain.
Yeah.
Perhaps rather than it's not so much that the sheath is unexpected. Mm-hmm. It's more how it's been introduced into into the other sorts of into the way you've not so much dealt with the building, but understood the building in a sensual way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the introduction, and you know the building doesn't. The building's not bleeding anything but air.
Yeah.
The stain doesn't leak from the building.
Yeah.
But the stain's being made by what fruit?
Clay.
Clay. I thought it was pomegranate. I keep thinking it's pomegranate.
Yeah, because it looks like. Yeah, it's just terracotta. Earth cheese, literally. I mean, you know, that's. So.
But why? And I know I'm harping on about this, but I really do find this a. You know, it's a really important thing for me to try and understand as to why that decision to sort of introduce that in a way with the pin, the rag paper, rather than there's many ways you could introduce that concept into this show.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've chosen to do it in a very some may say provocative, other people may say sort of revered and traditional way of doing it.
Yeah, bold. It's bold. It's provocative.
It's triggering.
You're trying to get I mean, this light is too bright at the moment. This light's meant to be really dim, but because of the old electrics in the building, it kind of, you know, varies even though it's on a dimmer switch. Because the last thing I wanted to do is to do what it's starting to do now, and it shows too much texture.
And it's kind of outside of viewing hours.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Opening now, so.
That's right, so it's getting darker, therefore the light seems bright. I think what Ted was talking about, that it rubs against the grain of a kind of New Age positioning in relation to romanticism, is very much where I'm at in relation to that.
Yeah. But there are many ways you could have done that.
There's a million ways I could have done it. Right. But it wouldn't have been the same. It would have been different work.
Yeah. Like you initially talked about stopping up the fireplace with solid clay.
Yeah, that was actually one of my original plans. A plug to the breath. Again, this is going to punch a hole in the middle. In that kind of really strong physicality of it, that has an incredible strong relationship with the use of, you know, raw clay and buildings and the whole history. It's one of my master's thesis. It's about 25 years.
It turned the chimney definitely into an anus.
Yes, it would have. It would have, for sure. And that would have been fine. But again, it would have been a different work. It was about the being able to be subtle with the space. It wasn't that I was. By no means am I afraid of making a bold move, and I've done that probably in a lot of my outdoor work, particularly my tech space work too. But I wanted to try and maneuver it so that it was more open, and it couldn't be about the material. I didn't want it to be about the materiality, and that's a very hard thing to work against when you're working sculpturally. And that's had I brought anything down to ground level, that's what.
But just on a formal sense, it is quite material in its organic nature.
That's right.
We've been asked to look at the wonky geometry, you know, of this old building, and you know the sort of the way we've tried to meet that with our pieces of MDF in some way. Yet we've got this sort of organic paper which is loaded with sort of high art connotations, and I'm just wondering about that, how you feel about that.
I knew exactly what I was playing into.
Was it quite brand new or recycled?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and I'm going to give a game away here. I made those clay things 25 years ago.
Ah, okay.
So I'm trying to remember. I think it was new, but, you know, all new clay is like an oxymoron.
That's correct.
You know, it's infinitely recyclable, except once it's fired, then it, you know, goes into another state. But I've had those clay things for 25 years. I've never used them in anything.
I'm thinking about that fastidiousness for the vacuuming,
right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that
element of the work and of the making, and as you say, it's very much of the crafting. And anyone who understands clay or paper making, all big things in the 70s and 80s when I was in art school. Now, I made those at the Jabberwock Paper Mill at the University of Tasmania.
Sure.
And the funny thing about them is I asked the fellow who ran the paper mill if I could make them. Anathema to bring clay into a paper mill, anathema, because it's rust, right? And they will have rust from here to breakfast, and he forbade me to come in. So at night, my studio was next door. At night, I hoiked myself over the low wall, made 100 or so of them.
Really going out.
Took them all with me over the wall, like, you know, sort of elf going over the wall with a bag of them. It dried them all in my studio. And I actually couldn't reveal them the whole time I was there, and they've been in storage in my attic for the past 25 years. I've never used them.
The entire object, the paper and the clay, were made 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Or roughly.
So they were actually made entirely in the spirit of that time, but not for anything in particular. So in your interest in abstraction, say, I was experimenting as a sculptor would with a pictorial space. When you work entirely in form and space, when people are working parallel to you in the pictorial, it's a very frustrating kind of environment. You're always the kind of second cousin to the pictorial. Because things that are bounded by frame are about the image, so they're automatically thought to be, you know, from the 80s conceptual, automatically about the other. It's a very different kind of playing field within the field of sculpture, sort of spatial practice. Indeed, that's why I renamed the department that, because it isn't just about objects.
Yeah, sure.
It's about the space. Now, I haven't mentioned to anyone that I made them 25 years ago, because I don't particularly think it's important. I could have made them last week. I know how to make them. They're not that hard to make. I don't have access to a paper mill, but I could have made them on my kitchen table. And that's also a very important aspect. They aren't enormous. You don't need a commercial paper mill to make them. These are the really subtle things you're picking up on, Adrian, that they're simple, they're small, they're kind of crafty. They have that scale of the handmade, of the, you know, the portable, the transportable, the easily done, the backyard kind of. The backyard kind of art, or weekend art, or indeed even kind of a play.
Yeah, they're artists.
Yeah, and yet there are two materials that in the art world never meet. You know, they're clay and paper never meet. They're the two things you keep right away from each other. Because if you have a paper mill, it's all about purity.
Okay, yeah.
And if you have clay, it's also about purity. Because all sorts of things go wrong with clay.
But the glaze, coats the paper that makes the paper shine.
Yeah, if you
like kaolin.
Yeah, that's right. So
they do come
paper,
together.
That's true. I meant in sort of art paper making, but actually you're absolutely right. So normal reflex paper is embedded with kaolin, which is porcelain. It's just porcelain, and they heat roll it on, and that's what makes one side of photocopy paper work better than the other. So whether the kaolin is on that, or, you know, it's just soaked through from the other side. So you're quite right. They do come together. I hadn't thought that. So, I mean, whether I made them last week or 25 years ago, it doesn't matter, and that's why I hadn't mentioned it. But but what you're picking up on of that kind of craft movement, and there's a sense of that beginning to come back in, you know, highly industrialized society. We see a lot of movement back to the craft. And for those of us who've lived through it once, it's very interesting. It's like the return of flares. It's kind of, you know, it's partly deja vu, but it's interesting to see how it sort of reads in another way. And it's not like I'm trying to, I don't particularly want to play into that fully, which is why they're not where you can see them or handle them. You know, I could have put one on the frame on the wall if people wanted to experience it. Of course, you would have been one of the few people who saw them, because I mapped them out on the floor of where I wanted to put them, so you could, you know, pick one. Indeed, I think we held one and talked about it. For everyone else, they're they're remote.
They're out of reach.
And that's what I wanted to, and that it, I wanted to deny their craftiness and their objectivity, because what's important about them, as Ted has brought up, is the staying and that kind of, therefore begins to relate to this notion of the new age atmospherics, the same thing you're talking about, you know, the resonance of the universe and so on. I completely concur with that. But to also be a slap in the face of it. Because if I had a position on our relationship to nature, mine is that it's very important that we understand that we can, you know, that nature is a completely constructive concept for us and can only remain so. And until we entirely understand that, you know, advertisements or policies or government initiatives or anything that continue to romanticize nature and see it as other are kind of fallacy. Because it's only something that we experience through culture. We can't experience it outside of culture. It's impossible.
Well, it's interesting that Geraldine Bell, Kyla McFarlane, in their ecology project that Mama last year used that iconic Franklin River photograph. I can't remember the photographer.
Dombrowski, I think.
Yeah. As a linchpin and the fulcrum, if you like, of that particular exhibition.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's incredibly romanticized, sublime, sublime image. I mean, and that's partly my history. I come from that, you know, that sort of history of that Western landscape painting was very much a part of my training when I was doing my undergraduate degree in the States, and I landed in Tasmania only to find I'd landed in another version of it, you know, because I arrived there in 1984, which was the year after the dam. And now I'm finally going back.
Well, it's fascinating that you're going back, which is why I brought that up, because, you know, if anywhere is now sort of packaged up as sort of an exotic other.
Yeah. It's Tasmania. And for what purpose? It's a conundrum.
You know, $180 return?
I think it's going to be the compound, you know, in Australia, the compound that survives the climate change.
Very well made. I mean, I found myself doing strange things, like the house I bought there. I thought, how far it is above sea level? So, you know, kind of worked that out. And it's, you know, I was pleased when I found out that it was 15 meters more above sea level than my current house. And I thought, I'm worried about it. You know, like, it adds.
You're closer to the wave.
That's right. I can't remember which author it was that said this, but, you know, when serious climate change begins to happen, it isn't how far above sea level you're going to have to worry about, or how much petrol costs. It's going to be whether or not you can get a loaf of bread. You know, like, it's going to be really fundamentally confronting. But, you know, of course, I play into that too. Oh, 50 more meters. Hey, what does that give me? You know, another week. It's great.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in the environmental debate, not as a strident greenie, but as a conceptual, how I'm interested in how it's conceived. I'm interested in the idea of nature. I'm not interested in nature per se.
It's interesting, same relation to, I think it's John Gray's book, Straw Dogs. I read that book about where he argues that nature is a sort of prosthetic limb that we've created for ourselves. Yeah. That, you know, it's starting to atrophy off our own bodies. The limb will die.
I mean, I'm talking about even with empirical.
Thereby, we will die, and then, you know, we'll sort of the next species will create their own sort of prosthetic limb.
It can be conceived as objective, and it's objective by our standards. Again, that's totally anthropocentric in the way it's defined, but the way that the data becomes meaningful is only in relation to an anthropocentric position. It's interpreted. I mean, it's very interesting what's happened in Copenhagen and the whole thing that had happened in the East Anglia University of Pounds, but the data was what he misinterpreted, so that, you know, climate change was worse than we thought. And it's not even that I spent a lot of time worrying about climate change. I'm not necessarily trying to, you know, point people in that direction. I'm trying to open the sensitivity to the things that are there that, until they're perhaps truncated, aren't thought about. The way I used to do it in perspective, I tried to do with something physical. And it's also the years I've spent at DCA working in sculpture and special practice. I changed the name of the department to that. This idea of space and air and teaching students to treat space as one would a soul is...
And opening up the notion of space,
That's right. And it's very hard to trust
physicality.
That's right. It's very tricky in training people to do something like this. Mm. Leave that entire corner empty. Mm. You know, to just, it's not empty. And in group exhibitions, which always frustrate me, that and they frustrate me because I invariably will do something like this, and somebody will come and hang a painting on there and tell me that that space isn't being used. So when you use a lot of negative space, you kind of also...
Well, I was going to ask you about how working with another artist working in the enclosure, how that's still... Is that sort of...
No, it's been... actually,
I think...
Yeah, it's. I was a bit concerned to begin with, as I said to Adrian earlier in the year, it was a sound artist, I kind of thought, oh, okay. But I think after I spent a little bit more time here, I realized that she was actually going to have a harder time than I would because the place is so noisy. And I wasn't that concerned about it. I thought it was more interesting to have. I was interested in the idea of her work. And as Adrian's pointed out, it's, we're both doing a lot of cancelling in our work. You know, we usually... doing a lot of cancelling of the external world.
But she's experienced very similar problems than you have in the subtlety of the work
and
the audience
the
intervention
gallery,
needing to trigger the cancelling effect.
Yeah.
A lot of people saying, well, I can't quite get what it's doing, and you have to sort of spend time with it and really move through it, and two people really need to be in there.
Yeah.
Effectively, she's miking the outside. She's got a microphone dangling outside the building, which is bringing in a sort of live feed into the bank of two speakers. And as you pass through it, it's sort of a bit like that Bruce Nauman corridor piece. You take a couple of steps and it cancels out behind you. And before you get to the next bank of speakers, the sound from the outside is now on the next bank of speakers. And the speakers you've just left are your steps on the inside. So it's a simple binary. It flip-flops from the outside to the inside, but it triggers in sort of unexpected ways with this delay system she's got going.
Can you hear your own steps, or is it like the
noise? No, it's not quite. It's, you can't quite hear them. It's very, very subtle.
It's very subtle, yeah. And of course, the interesting thing is people always tiptoe into
steps. Yeah. And it presupposes you pass through it as well.
That's right. So when I was sitting in the gallery in single, because I saw her note about it, when people came in on their own, I made a point to interact with them with the work. But I equally found her work tricky to explain.
Exactly. But, you know, curatorially, I was quite interested in someone that was working with, you know, the building as a, you know, as a sort of organ, in a way, the inside and the outside, in an oral sense, and you were working with a sort of more material sense. But, you know, it's one of those cases that was, you know, possibly too literal and maybe didn't quite come across. But, you know, these are the...
Also, what was very interesting for me, this would probably be the last point, because originally the show was meant to be in October, November.
Yeah.
And not having known how important the light would be for me at that time, it was fortuitous for me that it was later, because the light... is better at this time. It's longer lasting. It would be better for the open, and one has to consider the open. So if it were October, November, that'd be gone. It's 7 o'clock, and we're heading to get away. But so it was fortuitous for me that it moved back, although we had that incredible kind of heat wave. Now, you know, it might have been different work if it hadn't been for that heat wave. If I hadn't spent 10 days at sort of 42 degrees in here, I don't think it would be the same work. I think I'm
well, there is
different
a different
person.
There is a different heat curl.
And particularly
now,
this is the one I didn't have to cross.
And no water's got down through
there? Oh, when it pours. Oh, yeah, I've had to reconstruct it. I reconstruct it at the beginning of every week just to freshen it, but if it rains, I have to make a pilgrimage, yeah.
So, Kate, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask about, I guess it was a point that came up for me when you were talking about the other work and how one needed to explain the work in order, you know, to be able to understand the phenomenological effects, you know, which are, you know, like, I mean, with the Nauman, for instance, you don't need that. You know, like as soon as you walk in, you're trapped in this kind of endless route of seeing yourself disappearing, you know, and it's a very dramatic and immediate kind of effect. There's a great deal of mediation involved in your description of that work there, but also I think in this work too, and I don't want to take up the issue of, you know, how much a discursive exegesis or exposition of the work is required in order to fully understand it. Maybe we can talk about that in a minute.
Mm.
The thing that I wanted to do was say that quite a number of people had mentioned this work to me, your work to me, when I mentioned that I was going to come in and do this talk. And they all start talking about the chimney pots, and the chimney, they all mention that, right? So it's a kind of focus, but not in a Baroque sense, you know, like a positioning one. It's rather one that's kind of a launching pad for people to be able to talk about the work, right?
Yeah.
Now, the same thing happened to me when I came in. It was probably the first thing that I noticed and walked towards. I think then I noticed these, right? Mm. But I noticed that because, you know, there's a spill of light going down over the bricks, which is quite lovely, right? A little cascade of light, you know. And then there's the trompe-l'oeil effect, right? Now, I even, you know, I put my foot under there to see, you know, like, and I thought, I can't see the light pattern on my shoe, on my boot, and I took it away, and I really, and then I looked under, and I could see, it's still there, under there, you know, under the shadow of my boot. Now, I'm intrigued, you know, like, this is such a, you know, like a, I mean, some might call it a rather hackneyed kind of a trick effect, right? I think I called it a cheat.
Yeah, you did. Cheat was the first word I heard when I came in.
So, you know, I worked out the cheat, right? Yeah. And it does seem like a cheat because, you know, like, there's light falling down. It looks like it's illuminated, this grid of light on the basin. But, of course, it's not. You know, the thing that went through my mind was, I like that because that's I don't need any kind of explanation for it. You know, I discovered it myself.
Yeah.
I figured it out. You know, it's an enticing kind of game that you play with the fireplace, and you feel that you're stepping into it. Mm. You have to actually interrupt it in order to really grasp what's occurring, which you don't have to do with any of our work. You know, you can stay back, look at it, think about Terrell, or think about whatever, you know, maybe, you know, modernism, post-minimalism, and so on, with the work around on the walls. Mm. You think about that as an intervention that's very clever because it's the reduction of something, or the abstraction, the removal of something.
Yeah. It's very distilled.
This is definitely a work of art that's been installed, right? Mm. Mm. Yeah. Tell me about what made you think of doing something like this, of like, actually, I don't know if it's painted, it looks like it's painted. Looks like it's been sprayed, but who knows what it is, but it has definitely got a trompe-l'oeil effect. Right?
Yeah, it does.
Tell me about why you resort to the trompe-l'oeil.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought of it as a trompe-l'oeil effect, but I can see that it is. And indeed, at the opening, there was a number of people who had to head up the chimney because everybody wants to see where the light, after they work out that it's a light, then they want to see where the light comes from. And they were all surprised that it was just the natural light. So we were very lucky the opening was overcast. Of course, that's when it was overcast.
That's effectively on invitation.
Yes, that's right. And so... And the link was yes to that. How I came to that particular resolution, I don't know if I can actually tell you, but it was from spending, if I had to say it was from anything, it was from spending the time in here, and every time I blinked, I saw those damn 15 or two rows of 10, even two rows of 5 dots, because when you spend a long time in here, you see it. And I knew that I wanted to do something with the fireplace, but it was unresolved up until quite late. I thought I knew, but I wasn't sure. And I've tried a few different things, and then I intuitively, that's what popped into my head. What it is, to give the kind of game away, and a few people figured out, the little glass beads, which are perfectly spherical, which they put on line marking on roads. Yeah. When they paint a line on a road, they take handfuls of these beads and they throw them on, they stick to the paint, and they make it reflective. That it's just piles of them dusted through a template. So when it rains, they get exploded because the raindrops hit them and they turn into little volcanoes and get obliterated. And if it's windy, a lot of grit and other stuff falls down the chimney and also obliterates it. So I do have to come and refresh it every now and again. But it's that kind of sense of a dust or a pile of grit. And I experimented a great deal with how thin do I make it, just like frosting on a cake, just one layer of beads. Because I used to be a jeweler, I have enough control to make it just one layer. Like I have a very steady hand, so I can do that. What I don't have is a steady eye. I have a twitch in my eye, and that's why I couldn't be a jeweler anymore. But I then tried making them quite thick because they need. I thought, well, I'll make them objects because I'm being so ungenerous. All the other objects in the space on them, but that didn't work either. It took that tease too far. So it was the in between of not quite a painting, not quite an object, a thick dusting, an accumulation. And, you know, and if you grow up with snow, it's something you're familiar with. So it's that that just enough to obliterate the darkness underneath, but not enough, but thin enough to let that little bit of darkness come through, particularly around the edges. And so what led me to it was the, I don't know what that effect is called when you look at something bright and you end up with it on your eye.
After inch.
Yeah. And that's where it came about. I spent a lot of time drawing everything towards the chimney, and I knew that the chimney would become the you know, functionally kind of the quantum of the work, and that what happened in that light space had to be drawn to, because also it's fickle, and sometimes when there's a lot of people in the space, or at the opening a few people missed it. I found myself at the opening going, "Hi, how are you? Thanks for coming. Have you seen the fireplace?" Because when you get sort of to pick in here, you didn't see it. And I know that for a lot of people, busy time of year, Christmas coming, this would be the only time that they would be there. But it's interesting that you went right to it, because it was an empty space and the light was just right. Actually, when I popped by, I dropped in earlier before you arrived. The light was not good, and it was very dull, and you couldn't see it. But when it's right, it's right. But it's the atmosphere. It's whatever is happening outside, and I have to be perfectly happy to live with whatever happens for whatever person comes in at that time. And it's so in that way, it's very democratic. it doesn't behave the same way all the time. It does whatever the weather is doing. Indeed, when the professional photographer came, it was a sunny day, and it wasn't as good. And we had to get him back when it was cloudy. Because in a photograph, of course, it's hard to get it just right.
But I think of it as the closest sort of element in the show to photography. In that, to me, it's a work that stills the passage of time. Yeah. And the fact that it's in the fireplace, to me, is sort of, you know, where it's ended up.
Yeah.
Because I'm not really sure if this has happened since you've been here, but certain times of the year, the sunlight will leave that, that will, is it, how many dots is it?
15
dots, and they will track across the floor.
Ah, right, no, I've not seen that, but I can imagine that would happen when the sun's very,
when
the sun's very low in the winter.
It must be more of a sort of early winter effect.
Yeah, when the sun's low.
And they start over here, and you know, by about 4:30 or so, they've tracked their way across almost to the fireplace.
Great big bed.
I'll have to hunt through some documentation.
You'll have to. I'd love to have a show.
And then, of course, it stops.
Yeah, and then it...
And I wasn't sure whether you'd seen that effect.
Yeah, no, I haven't. Or if I had, I'd forgotten it. I probably haven't.
I was going to ask you about when you talked about the idea of locking in with clay and stuff. When you came here, you're not coming into the show black... space of black, windows were flooded? No,
they were all empty.
And you saw this, did you see that light at that time?
No, I'd seen the light in the fireplace previously. Well, and also just going back to the Linden exhibition, I had a framework work in the fireplace, and I also dealt with fire. In that tree, it was made in an electrical oven. So I had noticed the light in the fireplace before. It's something I notice in fireplaces. Oh, the last time I noticed it was in Bernard Sack's show, although he had lights on.
Yeah. Oh, we had plenty of lights.
And I thought it was in Bernard's. Maybe it was in another show, but it was a show this year that I noticed it. Or maybe it was...
If it's a blockout video show, it's really nice.
Yeah,
so,
it might have been. I can't remember whose show it was in, but I remember thinking, bent him over for later.
Yeah, well, what leads to the plugs having a, being pulled back... Did they figure that, or was that already quick to...
You say the plug, sorry.
The halo,
Oh, what led to that?
Does that trigger that? What comes first?
Oh, it's a chicken and egg question. Well, it is. Sorry, in terms of my making, these came first. I had to get the level of the light right, to get that right, to then get the ceiling right. So yes, it's partly a chicken and egg question. In terms of wood making, it was 1, 2, 3. But that was actually primarily from the word go. That's what I wanted to work with. I said, Adrian, I wanted to work with the beds. Because I was also trying to put you at ease. Because I understand that the way that I work doesn't put people at ease. Even with my galleries, because it doesn't... I have to...
Well, for me...
Online,
for me, it was fairly comfortable, because, at the beginnings of Chronicles programming being very much architectural intervention. Yeah. We've moved away from that a fair bit over the last few years, predominantly because I don't always think the most interesting contemporary practices are working in Champagne anymore.
I don't know.
So it wasn't it wasn't sort of uncomfortable. It was quite familiar.
But because I shifted what I wanted to work with, and I thought I'd like to try and work with the fireplace if it's the right time of year. And I only knew that once I got in. So
I think your relationship
assured, but it was always central. It was just what I was going to do with it. And I mean the loaves of clay made it as far up as the landing. They were in my car. They made it to the landing. They didn't make it any far.
I like your remark about the fireplace being the nearest thing to photography. Intriguing, adjacent kind of perspective on the work. And the way you describe the transit of these the light coming through these air bricks and vents across the floor towards this fireplace. It actually introduces another thought, it's almost as well as the one about photography, in terms of the impression of light and so on. But when you were describing that, I was thinking, this is like that the sort of elaborate and fantastical systems of orientation and revelation that occur in movies about tomb raiders and so on. Like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you've got to be standing at the right time, one time only every year, 3:25, and the light will pass.
That's Larrow got that once every 100 years.
Yeah. The Shrine of Memories,
suddenly I'm thinking, this turns this entire place into a kind of coded repository, kind of tomb of meaning, right?
Which is somewhat repugnant to me after all these years.
I'd be very pleased with that, actually, because I think that the thing that's so charming about these sorts of the sense of adventure that's associated with breaking the code over the tomb, and there's always a curse that goes with that, is that it's the antithesis or inversion of that New Age idea that we were speaking of before, of being, finding harmony with the flows and cycles of nature. This is something that's completely opposed to that. This is something that says, we only use nature because it's a convenient signaling system. Mm-hmm. And it's convenient because what it signals towards is treasure. So you're raiding nature all the time. You're using it to actually either conceal or to, find your way back to where you've buried the treasure, to where the X marks the spot. That's very charming. And I think now of that as being like X marks the spot.
That's right.
it's where the treasure
is. Sort of like the sundial.
A little bit of fireplace.
It's been used that way quite a few times.
Was the Tyson Athlete Port Salt down there? Is that right?
No. Tyson Athlete Port Tori Nimable.
That's right.
Yeah. I was thinking more in terms of some of these plastic bags suspended in front of the a cheap projection screen in that idea of capturing a tracking movement across the space. His was introduced. Yours is actually tracking something that's happened, but fascinating to know that you hadn't seen it. I assumed that you'd seen that at some stage.
Susan Jacobs said he dies going.
But it's interesting your comment about photography in relation to the Ipso Photo Show, because that's what that exhibition was about. And I saw Susan Faraday just the other day because she has an exhibition on at Monash, which is her PhD show. And as you may know, she's living in Germany now. So she's not in Australia very often. Mm. And we're all mates, so I thought, I'll pop into her exhibition. And we were talking about Ipso Photo. And she wasn't aware that this was on. She's going to come tomorrow. And as you know, she works a lot with light and shadow and play. And her show, which is her PhD exhibition, is very much focused on it. Mm. And she said that she thought that the debate hadn't really been continued in terms of some of what was brought up in Ipso Photo with the role of photography and in relation to the physical, and that there was still more to be teased out there, and that it seems like the string of that debate has perhaps been lost.
Yeah.
And, I need to come back to Australia and start it again, Susan, but I don't think I'm going to get her, entice her out of Germany just yet. But
That was quite interesting. Yeah, yeah. She would have made the connection with you too, with she wrote the catalogue essay for Son and Maidment's and yeah. Paul, I've forgotten Paul Serdan. Shepherd's show here back a couple of years.
Because that was yeah. that was a big atmospheric show, particularly yeah. the photographs.
Yeah. Manufactured yeah. atmospherics.
Yeah.
You know, the artificiality of atmospherics.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, you know, flip side of the same coin.
Yeah. Mm. Interesting. All right, well, I guess the only other thing I did want to ask about was working back within, I guess, a building. But the building also happens to be a gallery,
yeah.
you know, for better or for worse.
I don't actually particularly love working outdoors. Working outdoors are very hard.
Yeah, but I wonder about the pull not back in, not just into the architectural,
yeah.
but into the you know
into that into the kind of
into space the gallery and system and
it was just know. The right time to do it for a period of time. It was a good thing for me not to do it and to challenge myself in terms of the kind of traditional things of sculpture. Because I came into sculpture kind of by the back door, you know. I was a jeweler, then a ceramicist, then, you know, and then sculpture. So over the trajectory up to my master's, then my master's degree, I'd done all three of those things. I mean, and this is the outcome of going to an art school that didn't, you know, you didn't claim a major. You just kind of moved around and eventually claimed a major. He eventually claimed a major later on. So, you know, I've had a kind of grazing approach to practice for a long period of time. Probably the thing I probably did the most deeply was being a jeweler. That's actually where I put myself through college in the US. I worked as a jeweler for I worked as an apprentice for an artist, and I also worked at a commercial jewelry store. The equivalent of Zales, it's called Zales in the States. I spent summers setting solitaires. I can't look at a diamond. Can't bear the thought of them, and ethically anyway, they're horrible things. But but apart from that, this kind of, you know, my practice has been had a lot of different facets, and it isn't that I'll stop working outside, but it was the right time to come back. I mean, I've not worked in the commercial domain. It's not that I haven't tried earlier, 10, 15 years ago. You know, approached a few commercial galleries, but because I was making a living as an academic, I wasn't willing to compromise what I was going to do in order to produce some things that were going to sell, because that wasn't the direction my work was taking. And it was more important for me to be kind of honest with that in terms of what I was interested in doing and pursuing. And if I could make a living as an academic, why would I worry about, you know, making sure I have little offshoots that are easy to sell? Because I'd done that as a jeweler. You know, if I wanted to continue in that line of work, I would have stayed doing what I was doing. Because in the States, as a jeweler, I was you know, successful. So anyway, the move back inside, it was kind of the right time. And I hadn't done it in Melbourne, and you were in the right place in relation to a lot of other places that I've showed, like the CCP nearby and so on. It was the right time.
So you think you're thinking about working with?
I'd like to do more indoor shows.
Other galleries.
It was also about reminding myself, primarily, but of course other people who supported my work at the time, the kind of work I do in this regard. I'm also conscious that in the 6 years I've been at the VCA that I've only done outdoor works, and quite a few of those have been in Queensland, so people didn't see me either. I have a lot of connections in Queensland, so I show there a lot. And I knew that it was, you know, in terms of what was happening in my practice, the right opportunity to do that. That I had happened to be ended up leaving Melbourne was coincidental, but it was a happy group for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want any parting comments there, Tim?
No, I'm fine.
Thank you so much, Jeff. You did say it.